Well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bob Elson. We're set as usual for our Saturday afternoon show. And an old friend of ours is going to be our guest here at Northwest Federal today. That's Jim Enright, who's really had, a varied and an exciting career as a writer, as a referee. And now in the summertime, you can find him up in the press box at Wrigley Field. You know that, Jim, that must be an enjoyable job. Anybody who loves baseball like you and I do.
Yeah, it allows me to keep in touch with the game, Bob. But the best part of it is you work 2 weeks and then they hit the road for 2 weeks. So you can plan. You can plan a little life. It's just like, you know, Wrigley Field. They say it's the only park in the world without lights. When it gets dark, you get up and go home.
I heard a few years ago from what I thought was a pretty good source that the present Wrigley, William Wrigley, Bill Wrigley, was going to put lights in. I know at one time during the last war they had the lights.
Yeah, his father had the lights. Yeah, and they gave the wiring and everything to the war effort.
Yeah, Great Lakes.
Yeah, Great Lakes is right. It went right out there with Commander Olson.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot of people don't realize that, but that's how close they came to having lights.
That's right.
Is there somebody against the business of lights at Wrigley Field, at the Cub organization?
No, I'd say it's tradition more than anything else. It started with the first William Wrigley Jr., the original owner of the ball club. I don't think lights were in vogue while he was still the president of the ball club. It really came into full view when Phil Wrigley was the president of the ball club and served all those many years. And you know, Bob, one of these years, Phil Wrigley, deservingly, is going to be in the Hall of Fame to keep you company at Cooperstown.
Well, I hope so. I was always fond of him.
Well, he was in, he never stood pat. I can remember Dick Drott told me his first year, freshman year, here's a kid from Cincinnati pitching for the Chicago Cubs, and what happens? He had four raises during the season because Mr. Wrigley said, now, do you think we're paying that young man enough? Now, maybe that hurt the kid, but at least he got four different raises in one season. And they were all carryovers for his next year's contract. So you can't dislike a man like that. And Mo Dabowski, you know, I've always said that Mo Dabowski came to the Cubs with the Sporting News under one arm and the Wall Street Journal under the other. And, Mo made a good buck, too. But he's another one that would vote for Mr. Wrigley because he believed if you produce this year, you should be paid this year. It shouldn't carry over.
Well, I've been fond of all the Wrigleys. They're really, really nice people.
Class people. You knew Mr. Wrigley and you'd see him, you wouldn't know whether he had a dime or $10 million in his pocket because he was that unassuming and, this and that. He had great pride in his ball club.
You'd call the Wrigley Company and ask for Phil Wrigley, and he'd say, this is Phil Wrigley. He'd answer his own phone.
That's right. I got a couple of tickets for this Cardinals, the Chicago Cardinals. We're in Bradley. I was working at Bradley this night, and after the game, we're down to the lounge at the Pierre Marquette Hotel, and so we're talking to sports stories, and so I said, if you could call the Chicago Cubs, the Wrigley Building, and ask for Phil Wrigley, it's 10 to 5, he's going to answer the phone. The guy says, you're crazy. I said, all right, do you see those two kids sitting over there? I'll get two tickets for the Cardinals for him for the big game against Washington, and you'll pay for him if I'm wrong. I'll pay for him. If I'm right, you'll pay for him. So next Monday morning, he dials his Superior 7-2-1-2-1, whatever the number was. I'd like to speak to Phil Wrigley. This is Phil Wrigley. And he bought the tickets for the kids and threw in a couple of sawbucks so they could have fun at the game.
They've been a remarkable family, all of them.
Yeah. Well, there wasn't the great emphasis on you had to do this, you had to do this, we're going to keep up with the Joneses. Just his reaction to the black athlete in the National League. Ernie Banks didn't come up alone. He brought Gene Baker up with him. Why did he bring Gene Baker with Ernie Banks? Because he wanted to make sure that all the pressure wasn't on one person. And here was Gene, that was in the farm system. They got Ernie from the Kansas City Monarchs, and they had two ball players. And with his savvy that Baker possessed, he helped Ernie become really an outstanding star from day one.
Oh, he really was. That was a really outstanding ball.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, he was so relaxed, Bob. I've often kidded him. I said, you know, Ernie, I think you could sleep standing up in a phone booth. And I really mean that. He'd come in, you know, and had the loose wrists and give me the ball out there. It didn't make any difference whether it was a curveball, a fastball, a knuckleball. If he got good wood on it, bye-bye, Sally. It's gone.
Where were you in the Kyler Stevenson years?
I was writing sports in Benton Harbor, Michigan for then the News Palladium. It's now changed to the Herald Palladium. And there was two things I used to do. I used to sneak over to Chicago for opening day with the Cubs. I was working, earning $15 a week then. I'd see the Cubs opening day game, and I'd frequently get to the All-Star baseball game if it was in this neck of the woods. But ever since I was in high school, I had set out to be wanted to be a baseball writer.
How well did you know Gabby Hartman?
Quite well. I used to call him the great Gabbo, you know, that just stepped out of Marshall Fields. He dressed up like high mass wherever he went all the time. And to me, Gabby and Phil and Stan and Paul Derringer, about six of them came over to the House of David Park on a Saturday, football Saturday, and we had a crowd field for the game. You know, Benton Harbor High School's playing here, St. Joe's playing there. Waterville, Eaton, Coloman, everybody's playing over here. But we had the baseball game, and on account of these great names, and they all showed up. And I think they got $25 apiece.
What's happened to Cavaretta?
Cavaretta was with the Mets in the farm system, and he goes around. He's their hitting instructor. And he's pretty good man. He told me, he says, if they just leave Mr. Dave Kingman alone, he'll hit. I said, well, pardon me, Bob, they've left him alone all season, and I haven't seen any hitting, so you better try another track, Phil.
Is there any particular problem with Kingman? Does he have other things on his mind besides baseball?
Other things on his mind, but I think Dave was born to be a loner. He loves life alone, and when he sneaks into the training room after a ball game, that's out of bounds for the press. That means he doesn't want to talk to the press. And if I was covering baseball in this era, they didn't want to speak to me, that's fine. I'll go to guys that will.
Sure. Because does he still park out on that club?
I don't know. It's his life well enough to say, Bob. I don't know.
Well, he used to live on a boat right off of Addison Street Harbor.
Oh, well, you millionaires that know that. You live right across the street from him, you know.
I don't have a boat. I don't have a boat.
But you got that that condo, that big apartment up there with the vault in it.
Well, you know, the sports world, things really don't change much. They say, you know, what's new about baseball?
Only the names.
Yeah, really.
The game's the same, the names change.
Yeah, the game of baseball, there's the designated hitter and the turf.
That's right.
Isn't it?
That's right. And also, the way Finley dressed up that clown baseball team he had at the start. And then that clown baseball team, what happens to them? They become world champions. They're in three World Series in a row. So figure it out.
Are they going to bring that chicken back?
The chicken to Wrigley Field?
Yeah.
Well, with the attraction that he is, I'd say they're crazy if they don't. Because if it's nothing more than something for the kids to talk about, the chicken is there. And the chicken, by the way, is a pretty good entertainer. His timing is beautiful. I've just met the fellow, but he's been in Wrigley Field twice, and he's had the fans in the palm of his hand both times.
I wonder how he ever dreamed up that act.
I don't know. I really don't. Of course, you work for a radio station. Maybe that's the chicken. Maybe you're going to become the turkey.
No, you know, not me. Not me. Anyway, the baseball will be here before you know it.
That's right. The counting off until March 1st, and Lord willing, we'll get to go to Arizona and be with the Cubbies and be with the teams that are training in that area.
What were a few of the highlights of your writing career?
Well, I scored the Don Cardwell no-hitter. You must remember that. It was the second game of a doubleheader, and It was Don's first start for the Cubs. He pitches a no-hitter in his first start. And, you know, what's left for an encore? What's he going to do next?
Yeah.
And Eddie Stanky was the super scout for the Cardinals, and he's sitting next to me, and he's going like this. He said, what would you call that if the ball got through and everything? I said, hey, will you let me alone and concentrate on the ball game? There might be somebody out there that you might like to have for the Cardinals. Ah, no, he says, hey, we're a better ball club than the Cubs. Well, they weren't that day. And I can still hear Joe Cunningham beef. You know, they called the last strike, the last pitch of the game was a call third strike, and that was it. And Joe Cunningham exploded like it was the 4th of July. Yeah. And don't forget, also Moose Morin making that great knee-high catch.
Yeah, that was really
in left field. But, you know, Bob, they talk about Moose Morin was a flake and all this. He was not. He was a good defensive outfielder because he led the National League one year with 19 assists. Now, you try that on for size. That's a pretty good feat.
That's a lot of assists.
Yeah.
What about your years in basketball? Which is your favorite sport?
Well, I always wanted to be a baseball writer, but I always felt that if I had one talent that the good Lord gave me, I could referee a basketball game. And I felt that right from, you know, I went through a lot of errors. I went through the Chamberlain era. I worked for Bill Russell when he was with San Francisco. I worked with Jerry Lucas, Eddie Calafat. And then great teams, Mike Novak at Loyola, and even I worked several games at DePaul for Ray Meyer before we had our little falling out. Didn't see eye to eye. And it was a draw, really. I loved a good low-scoring baseball game. I guess I was a pitcher's official scorer because I loved the low-scoring game, and I enjoyed working a basketball game.
I agree with you about low-scoring baseball games. I think they're more interesting.
Well, sure, it brings out the best. There's got to be a bear-down situation on every play. Every play is hanging in the balance.
That's it.
Yeah.
Well, those college basketball doubleheaders that you used to have a lot of fun refereeing,
oh, yeah.
I really miss those. I don't care for the pros, but I sure did like the college.
Well, the college is play for keeps. There's the spirit. There's the cheerleaders. There's a dress-up in collegiate basketball that the pros can't match. And, you know, in the old days when we were officiating in Notre Dame, George Keegan, God rest his soul, he'd put the band right in back of the visiting team's bench. And when the coach would try to talk to his team, you know, the drummer and the cymbals and the tuba and everything, you could hear the band in Elkhart, you know. And the coach could never talk to his team.
I wonder where the strength is going to be in college basketball this year.
Right down at Belden. There, that team.
DePaul.
Is awesome. Absolutely. I was in Springfield a week ago for the DePaul opener, and the team really is awesome. And here's what they got. They got a game breaker in Aguirre, and they got a playmaker in Bradshaw, and they're surrounded by three pretty good ball players. And it's a parlay that's going to be tough to beat. I'm not going to say they're going all the way. But the team that beats him has got to show up with something more than Tom Thumb and the chicken you talked about.
Well, I'm happy for Ray Meyer, who's really one of the nicest guys in the sports world.
Strictly a class guy, as you can read. I wrote 224 pages in our book, Ray Meyer, America's Number One Basketball Coach. And I can knock on wood here. The book is enjoying a tremendous sale. And it's been very popular, and it's turning out to be quite a Christmas gift item. So maybe we'll have a winner in Chicago besides.
Well, I can vouch for it. It is a wonderful book, and any basketball fan, in fact, any sports fan, anybody who's ever heard of Ray Meyer will enjoy it.
Well, you know, here you go through the book, and he had an 11-year rivalry with the Harlem Globetrotters. Now, how many people can say that? He coached all of the United States All-Stars, the all-collegiate team, against the Globetrotters for 11 years. And they'd start out the tour with a day-night doubleheader in Chicago Stadium or Madison Square Garden, and then they'd go all over the country, 18 different cities. And it was a bonanza for Abe Saperstein. And, you know, Uncle Abe, God rest his soul, he paid well. If he had an extra $100 in his pocket and some athlete needed a pair of shoes, go get the shoes. What'll I do with the change? Keep it, you dummy. You
know? I really enjoyed Abe Saperstein. We both worked at stores on Lawrence Avenue. His father had a tailor shop, Saperstein's Tailor Shop, and he delivered for them, and I worked at the grocery store next door.
And your father had the mint.
No. But when we weren't delivering, we were shooting quarters out there. We'd draw a chalk line. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, one of the things I remember about Abe Saperstein, my late wife and I were in Rome, and my cousin was the chancellor here of the Archdiocese, so we had a chance to meet the Pope. And who's sitting up there with two dogs to give the Pope Abe Saperstein?
Saperstein.
He had two little chocolate-colored poodles
for
the Pope.
One was named Harlem and the other Globetrotter.
Those were great years, weren't they?
Yes, they were. You know, and I'm not going to say the kids today aren't having great years. I was at Loyola last night. They score 113 points. I think it's a crime to run up that many points on a little school like Lawrence. Their season is ruined, Bob. Yeah. But who am I to tell the coach what to do? I just wouldn't. And, you know, George Keegan, the coach at Notre Dame, had a great theory. He says, always remember one thing. There's always a tomorrow. You run up 40, 50 points on a coach each day. Maybe the next time around he does it to you. And you find out you don't like it any better than he did.
That's true. Do you remember Lenny Sachs?
Very well. I used to officiate with him. Sure. Sure, and he was a hell of a coach.
Yeah. Coach at Loyola.
Loyola, yes, and he played in the Knights of Columbus League. You know, he got around and played in a lot of places.
Well, they had great teams in those days.
That's right. And on top of it, you know, there was a social event. They'd play 40 minutes or 32 minutes of basketball. Then they'd clean out the joint and have a dance. It was a social affair.
Yeah, that's right.
Afternoon tea dancing, really. In other words, afternoon basketball dancing.
What about basketball today? Is it does it stay at the same level of popularity? Is it on the increase or has the popularity gone down?
I'd say, Bob, from a popularity standpoint, it's still climbing for the simple reason that you're making more converts with each year, with each new team. We'll never see another complete total reign like UCLA had, 10 championships, you know, because now you recruit one or two boys a year can make you a contender. And these are the things that are going to happen. The talent in high school is improving to such a point that freshmen are playing in an awful lot of schools and major schools and on pretty good teams.
Boy, UCLA had some great ones, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. And listen, before he's all through, this kid Bradshaw at DePaul is going to make you think of the little Warren kid that played for Johnny Wooden for 3 years. And, you know, he's from South Bend. And in my opinion, Mr. Bradshaw is another Warren. Right now I'm sparring for his name, but and I'm not sure of it, but he was there. And then also he had the Bibby kid, too, who was the brother to the pitcher.
Oh.
Yeah.
So they have an athletic family.
Oh, yeah, very good.
Do you enjoy that work in the press box at Wrigley Field?
Oh, yeah, because I'm seeing, you know, all fellas like yourself. You come back, Johnny Carmichael comes up to see at least a game a week. And the New York writers haven't changed too much, and so in St. Louis, and so I know most of the old writers, and I'm getting to know some of the new.
You just hit on one of my favorite people, John Carmichael. There's really a
great,
terrific guy.
Great talent, yeah. And what a storyteller! Yeah, I'm telling you, he spoke at the Cubs old timers game. They had a banquet for the visiting players, and I'm telling you, he had the whole arena, about 450 people tied up right in his hand for at least 15 minutes. And the longer he talked, the better he got, you know.
Jim, it's been real nice to have you as our guest here today. You know you're one of my favorite people.
Well, that puts me on the list.
You got that money belt on.
Yeah, yeah. Mine's fat. Yours is gold.
Nice to have you with us, Jim.
Thank you, Bob. Take two and hit to right.
Our guest today, Jim Enright. Very popular sports figure for many, many years, and an old friend of ours. Have a happy day, and now this is Bob Elson saying goodbye until next Saturday at our usual time.